This is RJ City, and you are listening to Let the Hate Flow Through You with Jeremy Shear and El Yordano Diablo.
Let the hate flow!
Available on the Lousy Weather Media Network.
Welcome to Let the Hate Flow Through You, your weekly dose of audible hatred. I'm Jeremy Shear.
El Yordano Diablo.
And this week on the show, we are joined by sociology professor Tim Gill.
Welcome, buddy.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Happy to have you.
Happy summer indoors.
Dude, it's hot as hell. My internet to my room is just not working, so I'm gonna go out in the living room. Sorry.
Well, hopefully you don't get too sweaty on that walk, fatty.
I mean, I generally would. But I guess we should tell people Tim is the guy who nicknamed me El Yordano Diablo 12 years ago.
That's right.
You guys get to hear from that guy. And he's a sociology professor, so that should speak volumes about myself.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, man. Probably 2007, 2008.
Somewhere around there.
So you gave this fat motherfucker a brand? How dare you?
I did. Yeah, I nicknamed him El Yordano Diablo. I don't even remember where out of it came.
From what I remember, it was just because you thought my fixation with Satanism was funny.
Yeah.
So you just combined your love for South American, politics and whatnot with me, and you kind of just shove those two things together, and
that's actually exactly right. That is actually right, because you were into super into Alkaline Trio and Satanism. I was learning Spanish, I was really starting it up then. I was 23 or 24, and I just somehow that just all came together, and I'm so happy it stuck around. I think it's a perfect moniker for you,
Yes, 100%.
Until MS-13 shoots him for appropriating their culture.
I think they'd welcome him with open arms.
I think
arms.
So too. Thank you.
I think he could be kind of a cultural ambassador for them. You know, maybe he could get some meetings with Trump, maybe, and try. maybe convince Trump to enlist their support or something like this.
And then from Trump to Putin, and then
Trump to Putin. I mean, anything's possible. Anything seems absolutely possible these days. With
send me over there, I'll play him a song.
Yep, exactly. Who knows? Maybe you can be, he can name you vice premier or whatever, and head of the Duma.
I'm actually going to be the adjunct leader of the New World Order, the Illuminati. That's actually going to be me.
Would you enlist some people from the actual New World Order, WCW?
Oh, without a doubt, those would be my constituents, my very close ones.
Horace Hogan would be his body double.
Oh God.
Get the
Scott Norton, Virgil. I saw Virgil last weekend. I saw a Virgil signed figure at a flea market here in Tennessee for $120.
Was he selling it himself?
No, that was the funny thing. I was thinking the same thing. I'm like, damn, that's more than he would sell it for, there's no one that's gonna buy this ever.
Not for that price.
No. And so it was magnificent.
Well, why?
The main question I have about this figure is it Virgil in his striped red and white pants, or is it Virgil in his tux?
Tux.
Tux. Okay.
Yeah. In the box, it's a Mattel Elite, and he's in a golden box, and he's in the tux. And I mean, I kind of want that actual figure. I haven't got it yet, but signed for $120, it's No, I would rather you could just buy it for $20 and get it signed for $5. You know?
Yeah.
Exactly. You're paying an extra $100 to not have to talk to Virgil.
Fair enough.
So, Tim, why do you hate U.S. foreign policy?
Yeah, I mean, good question. I hate U.S. foreign policy, you know, and I was thinking about it. A lot of my research as a professor looks at sort of post-Cold War U.S. foreign policy, so foreign policy since the 1990s. But really, as I was thinking about it, you know, after I was talking to Giordano, you know, really U.S. foreign policy, I think, since the inception of the colonies, has been rather disastrous, has resulted in death and destruction, genocide of Native Americans on the mainland.
Epidemics.
And that, so it goes back, I mean, even I think since the inception of the U.S. as a country, you know, the whole idea of manifest destiny, which Trump even referenced in a tweet, you know, the other day, that fondly referencing manifest destiny, which was this concept that the U.S. should really continually extend the borders of the original colonies. You know, this came into the into Ohio with, you know, Tecumseh, and then just increasingly outward, you know, different strategies, buying Louisiana from the French until, you know, the U.S. extended to the Pacific. And thereafter, of course, you know, there was the Spanish-American War, taking control of Puerto Rico and Cuba, and for a time, Cuba and the Philippines, Guam. And then, you know, coming up until the 20th century, just all the sorts of coups and government overthrows and interventions, you know, oftentimes to undermine democratically elected governments, you know, governments that were elected by oftentimes poor and working class people in places like Guatemala and Chile, Nicaragua, and then extending into the present. I mean, I think that U.S. foreign policy is so expensive. I mean, in every sort of level, I think U.S. foreign policy is rather reprehensible at the moral level of undermining the wishes of people abroad, undermining the democratic aspirations of people, not in every single instance, but in many instances. Right. Financially, I mean, that was spent.
They disguise it.
And they, yeah, it's often, it's often disguised as democracy promotion, human rights intervention.
Yeah.
And, you know, at a financial level that we spend so much money, you know, the cost of U.S. empire, that if we weren't paying, you know, if we weren't shelling out so much money for the 800 plus bases abroad, you know, we could fund good education. We could fund good healthcare. We could fund so much more research, you know, all the rest of it. So on so many different levels, you know, economically, financially, morally, you know, I think that U.S. foreign policy is just a total disaster. And it creates such a blind patriotism. They have so many folks that are just like blindly, you know, support the troops that are out there, that they're fighting for us, they're fighting for our freedom. And it's like, how was the U.S. fighting for freedom in Vietnam? How was the U.S. fighting for our freedom in, you know, even if you want to take that step, you want to take that philosophical leap and like, okay, yeah, they're fighting for our freedom. Like, how can you even, how was it that the U.S. was even fighting for our freedom or is fighting for our freedom? You know, it's kind of, so
opening up them markets.
Open up, yeah. A lot of it's about markets. I think a lot of it's about, yeah, getting access to markets, getting access to cheap labor. I think a lot of it's about allies, you know. We don't do a whole lot to undermine rule in Saudi Arabia, you know, because they're pretty much on board with us in terms of oil policy, in terms of security policy. We don't do a lot in places like Azerbaijan, who was on board with the war on terror, but then in places like Venezuela and Bolivia, countries that have, you know, sort of rejected U.S. global leadership, then we want to undermine those countries and highlight their alleged democratic deficits, if you will. And so I just, there's so many dimensions of U.S. foreign policy that I think are just, and since the origins of this, you know, country, that are just so regressive and destructive. And it's truly, it's mind boggling, the whole nexus of it all.
Yeah, I'd agree. But they're getting us to the edge of the continent did have its advantages. For one, Tex-Mex cooking.
Well, yeah, sure. I know, right? I know. Well, that's the horror of I can't remember what politician said it. You know, sooner or later, there's going to be like a taco truck on every single corner. And that's that would be amazing.
Yeah,
yeah, it would be.
That's not a bad thing.
Oh no, yeah. Taco trucks.
Yeah. So they, you know, I mean, yeah.
I mean, just it as would, far as like, so like the South American stuff, like they don't agree with like our I would call it militarization of the world, or at least having like our hand in it. Somewhat. So they just don't agree with us. So we want to have people overthrow their government. Like our people are entitled to their own rights. Like we don't run the world. And I think that is a lot of Americans' problems. It's like, oh no, we're American. We run the world. No, you don't. No, you fucking don't.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think that there still is, you know, that idea of manifest destiny, you know, that was sort of like a religious idea, you know, it was the idea that the essentially white Anglo-Saxon Protestant leaders of the country. And even if you go back, if you read Benjamin Franklin, if you read, you know, all these folks, Thomas Jefferson, they talk about how they are like the chosen people and how like, you know, the savage Native Americans don't know how to cultivate the land, and that, you know, these white folks, you know, they're the true stewards of land. And, you know, if the savage Native Americans want to learn their ways, then great. But if not, then we need to exterminate them, because, you know, this is our land, and it's, you know, God's land, and we know how to develop it. And I think that same idea rang through with Manifest Destiny, like, okay, we're just going to march across the continent because, you know, we really know how to control this land and we're the best ones to have it. And that's Manifest Destiny. It's our destiny, you know? And those same ideas, you know, maybe if they aren't talking about we're God's chosen people, I think you're absolutely right, Gordano, that like a lot of American, particularly like leadership, you know, and many citizens, you know, just look at the shirts in Walmart and Target, you know, this is the best country, you know, all these types of things, that we're the greatest, that there is sort of this idea, even if it's lost, it's sort of like spiritual element, that like, for whatever reason, like we're the chosen people. And like, we know how everything should be done culturally, politically, economically, and like, yeah, I mean, I that totally ring.
Well,
that
one of the youngest countries in the world.
Right. Yeah, I know. And it's really not even considered democracy by political scientists. You know, people are always saying, oh, it's the first democracy. You know, it's actually not considered democracy by political scientists really until the 1960s with the Voting Rights Act, you know? So like, yeah, I mean, the idea that it even should be this kind of example for the world is pretty flawed, given our own, you know, democratic deficits.
Yeah, well, unless other countries have an ethnic minority that they need to oppress, we're the wrong country to look at.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You know, I right. I mean,
There's nothing but truth to that.
Yeah, I mean, the Soviet Union, actually, during the Cold War, you know, their relations with, like, the Black Panthers, things of this nature, there was, you know, communist you know, leanings, many black radical groups into socialism, into communism. Some supportive of the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union, in their sort of propaganda wars with the U.S., would highlight the fact that the U.S. was oppressing racial minorities, particularly black Americans, you know, and they would have all these, you can find them on YouTube, you know, they would be playing this sort of propaganda, but was true that the U.S., you know, who does the U.S. think it is telling us what to do when, you know, you have black folks being lynched and they can't vote and police are, you know, attacking them and protests and all the rest of it. And it actually, you know, my understanding is this played very well for the Soviet Union and many at the time were called, you know, third world countries. And so,
yeah,
you know, if you were a black revolutionary group, you know, does it logically make sense to align with the U.S., you know, that has these racist elements, or, you know, the Soviet Union that's calling these out? I mean, it's more complicated than that, but, you know, these issues were at play, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's it makes sense if the money's there, honestly. If the Soviet Union is funding the Black Panthers, and yeah, why not take their money?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there was just a lot of like sort of linkages and you know, that there were some justifications, not necessarily just among the Black Panthers, but some folks saw, you know, the Soviet Union also just kind of as like, maybe it wasn't perfect, but it was sort of like, it was an alternative model to the U.S. Mm-hmm. that like, and maybe people didn't like, so for example, the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, like they were influenced by some nationalists. They were influenced by Jesuit liberation theology, Catholicism, and they were influenced by Marx and Leninism, and they were influenced by the Soviet Union. They didn't want to have a dictatorship, but they wanted to have, you know, kind of more state intervention into the economy. You know, they want to have, you know, literacy programs and healthcare programs. And, you know, the Soviets were willing to work with them on those. And maybe they didn't have the best political system, but they're, you know, in the Soviet Union, there wasn't homelessness. There wasn't the drug abuse problems there are today, the crime problems, you know. So, I mean, it was a model.
I don't know about that. only because like alcoholism has been a problem in the Soviet Union and those areas for millennia.
Well, that's why I didn't say alcoholism.
Yeah.
That's
why.
The drug problems like heroin and all these types of things. Like, yeah, that I didn't say alcohol.
Yeah.
But alcohol in many countries in Eastern Europe. Yeah, alcoholism. My understanding is that it's escalated in the post Cold War context. But yeah, no, I mean you're right. Alcohol was certainly there, and but the extent of drug problems and this type of thing, my understanding, you know, wasn't really an issue. That was, people were often scared. You know, I mean the thing, yeah. Alcohol. I have heard that. I don't know if this is true, but alcohol was considered like a food. Beer was considered a foodstuff in Russia until like, you know, just a decade or so ago. Before that, it was just considered a foodstuff, not even an alcohol. You know?
Huh.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Well, it was a way to get carbs before like everybody could make bread.
Huh.
You know, that's a good point.
And it's also a good way to purify water if you didn't have good water.
Hmm. With vodka. Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. The vodka is what's killing them. But post Cold War Russia with the crocodile and all the heroin coming from Afghanistan.
Yeah, I was in, it's funny, I was in Ukraine, like, my wife is from Eastern Europe, she's from Albania, and then we went to Ukraine, like, 2 years ago or something, and I was like, can I have some vodka? And they had pepper vodka, and I was like, yeah, I want the pepper vodka, and they're like, well, how much do you want? You know, do you want like a shot? Do you want like a half liter? Do you want like a full liter? It wasn't like, do you just want a shot or do you want like a mixed drink? It was like they had like four different gradations of levels that you could order of vodka just like right at the table, you know? And
how fucked up do you want to be?
Yeah, it was, and it was like, you know, it wasn't even like you're just eating a meal at a restaurant, and but that's like a traditional type of alcohol there, and obviously it might, you know, some places I guess in the U.S. would have like bottle service or something, but yeah, you're not gonna walk into like Ponderosa or like Shoney's and get like, hey, do you want a liter of vodka to go with that?
With your Salisbury steak, you want to get ripped?
that's what it was, and it was like, oh, awesome. So I got like a little. I don't remember. It wasn't. It was the degree below a half liter. It was like a quarter liter or something like this. So.
Well, all right. I personally would like to go into a Denny's, get a Moons Over My Hammy, and a liter of fortified wine.
I like that. Yeah, that would be. They gotta open it up. I mean, I think they would probably, you know, some of these restaurants, they could do some of these like gimmicks. They could bring more people out. I went into a Denny's in North Carolina. They had their own beer.
What?
Denny's?
Denny's Light.
What?
It was like $1.50 a pint or something like this. This is just, I have a picture of it. It was just like a year ago or something.
It's just recycled Genesee.
I think it's something like that. But I think that's, you know, at the end of the day, if there's something for the troops to be fighting for, it's probably shit like this, you know?
Yeah. You know, booze at Denny's.
Booze, yeah. Get your $1.50 Denny's Light. You can drink as much as you want. You don't have to wear a mask.
We don't tell you when to leave. That's why we're open 24 hours a day. You can move in if you want to.
Yeah, you can set up shop under the table, you know.
Don't mind the customers.
Perfect. Honestly, that would have, like, because as a kid, where do you go except
Denny's? Oh, exactly. We've talked about this so many times on the show, I feel like now. It's like Denny's is kind of like a catch-all for like for just youth. When you can't do anything else, you kind of just funnel all the Denny's. And
now pump them full of Denny's Light.
Can you imagine? Oh, my God. If someone had like a fake ID or like, yeah. Like you go in there, they have fake ID, you're pumping Denny's Light. But yeah, no, I totally hear you. I used to go like the Denny's on West 150th in Cleveland and just like, yeah, nowhere to go. It's snowy out or whatever. You can go in there and just chain smoke for hours and order like, you know, a fry basket or something.
Yeah. I would get coffee and a pie.
Instead of, like, you know, fear tactics, like, you know, like conspiracy theory, like FEMA camps. We need like Denny's dens. Like, listen here, disenfranchised youth. You can go here and do anything you want, kind of moderated. And, you know, we'll take care of you here at the Denny's den instead of, you know, like supposedly hurling people into cages and stuff. Like, I want to believe in like a brighter future where kids are alcoholics.
Denny's got you covered, man.
Anybody can afford it at that price. That's patio prices, Tim.
Dude, yeah, exactly. The patio. It was like $1.50. I think I asked them. I think they said like maybe Anheuser-Busch or something. I was like, what is this? You know? Because it was like when I went there, it was like 8 a.m. or something. And they said it was basically it comes from like Anheuser-Busch or something like that. Like it's probably Natty that's like them. Branded
repurposed, yeah,
exactly. You know,
when did you start get? Oh, go ahead, Sheer. Go ahead.
I don't understand how people drink Natty. I went to a quarter draft night in the valley in Akron, and all the quarter draft was Natty. I woke up and my kidneys felt like I had been punched like 50 times.
I don't know. I mean, I was talking to a friend yesterday, and they said they got a 6-pack of tall boys of Natty Ice for like $3.99. I was like, dang. I mean, I guess if you're, I don't know. I mean,
dude, it's like the equivalent, like not the equivalent, but it's like when I used to drink Triple X all the time, like that shit is just like swilled rocket fuel. That's all it is. Yeah. It doesn't taste good, and it gives you like gut rot. It's awful.
Yeah. No, King Cobra, man. That's what I used to do, the King Cobra in college, like get like, it was like $2, you know?
Yep.
And it was high grade. And there wasn't much, you know, this was before the Triple X, you know? So that was like about as high gravity as you were going to get. Natty Ice excluded, you know, it was like 2004. But yeah, I mean, yeah. I don't know. Sometimes I go to a bar, and I mean, 25 cents. That's kind of, is that what you said? 25 cents.
25 cents.
I mean, that's kind of. What do you even tip on that? 10%. What is that? 3 cents or something?
No, nobody's tipping at these things.
I mean, I just end up paying like a buck a beer because that's a good enough deal. Like, I just be like, here, keep the rest, or keep them coming. Rather, here's a five. Keep them coming.
I mean, this is the stuff I like about the U.S. You know, I mean. This is the stuff that, you know, the 25-cent Natty Light. And, I mean, not that I'm necessarily drinking it, but, like, I'm like...
Staples of American culture.
Yeah, you know, nickel beer night at Cleveland Municipal Stadium. Like, I like that shit, but, like, you know, yeah.
Imposing our will on other countries, not so much.
That's right, you know. I mean...
We're not even imposing the nickel beer nights and the 25-cent natties on other cultures.
Or hear that often. I mean, that should be like a regularity. Like, if you're going to invade a country, bring beer, you know? Like, why don't we sit down and talk about this instead of just laying waste to a fucking town?
Yeah, a beer summit, you know? You could do something like that, you know? I mean, it's fascinating, though, how some, you know, I just studied abroad in Australia. I remember they sold MGD there, but a 6-pack was like $30 of MGD because it was like, or, you know, so it was like, it was like cultural imposition, but,
how much is a 6-pack of Foster's here? You
know, well, that's the funny thing is because they knew that Foster's was like their cultural imposition. Yeah. You know, and they were like, they found it hilarious because they were like, cultures is fucking shit, you know, like, they're like, that's like terrible beer, you know, that we don't even drink it, really. No, it actually, it's not like, you can't find it all the time, like, you can find it sometimes in the store, you know.
I feel like it was more readily available like 10, 15 years ago than it is now, and I used to say like all the time, like when I started drinking, I would like when I would try a Foster's, I'd be like, that's just Australian for Budweiser. Like, it's just shitty. It's not good.
The best thing is the can, you know.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, yeah. Cause I mean, you're getting a deal at that point. And you know, you just chuck it back and then you find something else to drink.
Yeah, they got a green one now, I heard. Someone's
telling me there's a green one. Dude, Chelsea's dad drinks that shit all the time. They must have a store out there in Eastlake because he's like, he either drinks Molson Canadian, or which is nice because when I go over there, he has it, or like Foster's. Like, those are like the two beers that he drinks.
Two other Australia and Canada, two other like English settler colonial states. Except the U.S. You know, I don't know if you guys have heard this theory. This you might find this interesting, but there are some people out there that are like, it would have been better in some ways for the U.S. if, like, the U.S. actually never won the American Revolution. Because then we would basically be like Canada or Australia in our social policies. Not like everything would, you know, not like everything would be, like, perfect. Obviously, there would still be, you know, the anti-immigration sentiment that you find, anti-Muslim sentiment, but as far as like infrastructural, healthcare, education, childcare, these types of things, that things would be like a lot better, you know?
Yeah, I've never thought about that, but that is a very good point, because it's the writing's right there. It's there.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think there would have been a more efficient extermination of the natives had we lost the American Revolution, because it seemed like they were, we had the damn French and Indian War, and is just basically kill everybody. So that would continue.
Yeah, in those regards, it's hard to say how all of those aspects would have played out. I mean, my guess is, it probably would have been similar to what happened in a place like Australia, I guess, where you continue to have so many social it's really sad the way that Aboriginals are treated in Australia. When I studied abroad there in 2005, I thought like Australia surfing, people that just want to like chill, the internet was like still not, I couldn't find much information about, what was going on. And I was up in Queensland, the surfing area, but they were so like horrendous towards Aboriginals. And
that was something I learned within the last few years. I didn't realize how overtly racist that country is, I don't want, not all of them, obviously, but
not
like,
all of them. Yeah.
A portion of them. And it's like, it's very out in the open, and that's really fucked up.
Yeah. I mean, they were using words that they basically use racial slurs for blacks here in the U.S. They use those for Aboriginals and just openly, and not everyone, and at the time it just seemed very, and a lot of people, use those words in the U.S. openly in particular contexts, but I can still hear you.
We're good.
I mean, it is, because the image that's put out there about Australia is that it's like, fosters, kangaroos, surfing. So, Outback Steakhouse, Bloomin' Onion, so it is, I mean, it is.
Boomerangs.
Yeah, boomerangs. I threw one of those. I brought one back for my mom, too.
That's rad.
Yeah, those are cool. But, I mean, there probably would have been a similar, the degree, I guess, who knows. But, there certainly probably would still been, violence towards Native Americans. But I guess foreclosing all the particularities, some people say, if the U.S. didn't win, maybe things would be a little bit different in the U.S.
I do agree with that sentiment. I absolutely do believe they still would have wiped out the Native Americans. I have no, I just because of like just the systemic racism across the board, white people to any other people that aren't the same color. I do think that still would have happened. Violence in the world still hasn't, it hasn't dipped enough. Leading up to World War II, I mean, there was that was how things were dealt with. It was much less diplomacy, a lot less diplomacy saving lives than it was wars wiping out people or genocides wiping out people. And excuse me, I do think that would have happened, but I do think that at the end of the day, we're 80 years removed from World War II, we still have a ton of problems, but I do think that had those things been in place, socialized healthcare, all that shit, I do think that we probably would see that in this country today.
Yeah. It's interesting. It did take, a lot of countries in Europe because of, the shared experience of actually getting bombed and having all their infrastructure destroyed. Before World War II, many countries in Europe, England, Germany, France actually didn't have an extensive social welfare system, unemployment, this, that, the other. And The U.S. didn't have much until leading up to World War II as well, unemployment and Social Security. But after World War II is really in that context is when England and Germany, a lot of countries were like, okay, you know, we were destroyed. We're all in this together. We need to create a system that is going to work for all of us. And some say that's explains some of the reason why the U.S. didn't develop a similar social welfare system at the same time is because we didn't really face any decimation on our own soil besides, you know, the Pearl Harbor, which was, you know, far away from the mainland. And so that has sort of, you know, that history is also interestingly, you know, in part explained our kind of trajectory, coupled with, of course, after World War II, then we're the global superpower who has to, you know, police the world and, you know, and now have bases and maintain them and spend our money on that instead of solving domestic problems.
Yeah.
Right. There's, building up your domestic, you know, self, I guess.
So I think the solution then is we need to have a bloody revolution here so that there can be some decimation.
I don't disagree. I mean,
you see a lot of people making jokes. I don't make them, you know, but you see a lot of people making jokes on Twitter and whatnot about bringing the gulag out or bringing the guillotine. And this sort of a thing. So I don't know if people are, a lot of it seems just tongue in cheek, but there's no shortage of people out there who I think would very much welcome, you know, a kind of bloody revolution and think maybe that's what it's going to take for something serious to change. I was more hopeful about Bernie Sanders, you know.
Yeah, so was I. But now that, you know, it's clear that America's not ready to elect a Jew, maybe it's time to start executing the rich.
Yeah, someone had one that was like, because that meme is going around about like, open it up, it's a cake or something like that. Have you seen that going around on
Twitter? Oh, yeah.
So someone had a guillotine and was like, okay, let's line up the rich and see if they're cakes or something like that. But like, even that, but like that was like that meme. Those memes were coming together. They were emerging forces.
My favorite is still the guillotine that goes, I am hungry for billionaires. Makes me happy. So is, do you think that our foreign policy is a reflection of what's failing domestically, or is it just we've got being cops on our mind too much?
And that's a really good question. I think one is in fact what we're talking about, the legacy of there is that legacy of thinking we just are like global leaders throughout the world, and that it is our sort of role, that it's, you know, US leadership's role to police the world. And I think that, you know, yeah, many people are convinced that, you know, that this country is the greatest. And a lot of these families go back a long way, the Bushes, you know, et cetera. And I think, you know, and they go to Ivy League schools and they come up in an environment where they're constantly told that they are, you know, that they are the best and they are the chosen ones. And, you know, I don't think it's necessarily about power itself, but I think that they are kind of true believers that, you know, the U.S. is a great country. And if everyone were just like us and et cetera, et cetera. But I think there are probably instances where, you know, the argument is that presidents have tried to distract from domestic problems through appeal to foreign policy. So that argument was made, you know, with Clinton, for example, and everything was going on with Lewinsky and then the issues in the Balkans and Bosnia, et cetera, with Reagan, with his appeal to Grenada in the early 80s. I mean, I think that what you could definitely say is that many presidents have tried to
sort of demonstrate the global power of the U.S. through, you know, foreign policy endeavors. Some of them absolutely ridiculous, like invading Grenada and, you know, this tiny country that posed no threat. Reagan did that. Why? I mean, yeah, because he wanted to show a domestic audience and also wanted to show the world that, like, hey, if you, you know, if a government comes to power that we don't like, you know, we'll knock you out. And that's, of course, you know, that's supposed to be consumed at the domestic level as well. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think that's also with Bush and Iraq. I mean, I hardly believe that anybody truly believed that Iraq actually posed a threat to the U.S., a serious security threat to the U.S. They wanted to go knock them out to, you know, particularly after 9/11, looking kind of weak. That
they needed a boogeyman.
Yeah, they needed a boogeyman and someone to easily take. They needed a win, you know. They needed to take someone down.
And it had to be a name, too. Like, it had to be somebody that was already established. That that whole thing leading from Bush 1 to Bush 2 and the end of, like, that. Not even the end, because we're still fucking there. But, like, if you – because I have read up on that shit before. If you go back and start looking at – there is so much bullshit that lines up with one fucking agenda – that they had, that family had, in my opinion. And it is preposterous to me still that there's three terms between the two of them. And that's still like 75%, you know? So it's that's too much Bush in the office.
Right.
Thinking.
Right. Right. I see what you're saying. Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, yeah, I know. And then it's funny now because, like, yeah, I mean, Bush was like the biggest POS one could, like, pretty much dream of. And now you're in 2020 and people are like, you know, then Bush comes out and denounces Trump and people are like, oh, isn't Bush like a great guy? And you're like,
right,
what the fuck is going on here? Like, maybe they're both horrible, you know?
Yeah.
It's not like, you know, people are always like, well, who's worse, Bush or Trump? And it's like, maybe they're both terrible. It's not, it's not a baseball game, right?
And, well, just to look at Trump's foreign policy now, it just seems to be shouting at people. We're not really, like, not huge military actions have happened, except depending on who you listen to about what's going on in Venezuela.
Right.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, right. Yeah, the issue on Venezuela, if those individuals that tried to invade, if they actually, you know, had Bush or Trump's blessing or not. I mean, he assassinated the, you know, here's the thing, like, right before COVID, like, the huge story was, like, that assassination of the Iranian general, remember, in Iraq. And that was like, oh, my God. But then right away, then COVID kicked in, and that story was just, like, totally
buried.
Yeah, totally buried. But yeah, it's really odd, you know, it's so incoherent, Trump's foreign policy, you know, because he ran on saying, denouncing Bush and saying, well, he brought us into Iraq, which was a total disaster. But then he was saying, you know, I'm going to have the biggest military that the world's ever seen, you know,
Didn't he say he would turn the Middle East into glass or something like that? Or
maybe.
He said something along those lines, and he also said something like whatever he said at Kim Jong-un when he was like, you know, I'll wipe them off the face of the planet or something like that.
And then he's hanging out, then he's meeting with them, like, you know, a couple weeks later. I mean, it's totally incoherent. Like, there's not, I mean, it's funny because, like, he's like a B-movie actor, and then you have all these, like, PhDs, professors, you know, that are, like, trying to make sense of him. And it's like, honestly, maybe it just doesn't make sense. Like, it really, like, 1 minute, right, he said he's going to wipe them off the face of the map, whatever, and then he's meeting with Kim Jong-un. It's, oh, we're great friends. We write letters to each other, you know.
When Kim Jong-un was, you know, supposedly sick or whatever for that month, people didn't see him for 6 weeks, and Trump's, like, tweeting, he's like, I know what's going on, but I can't tell you. Like, fuck you, he's like a fucking teenager, dude. Like, right. I can't tell you, mom. I can't. Like, fuck off.
Yeah. I just see him as like a, still like a, the Apprentice host, like wait until next week, and then I'll review.
Yeah. But now it's just wait until tomorrow.
Yeah, it's like, I'm sorry, I alone have, you know, the answer.
I mean, dude, he's wiped, like, basically with all the people that have quit and been fired by him, he's gone through, like, two or three administrations already in less than a full term.
I know. I mean, I kind of want to read Bolton's book, but I also don't want to give Bolton any money, you know?
Yeah. That's what libraries are for.
Right, exactly. But yeah, I mean, I think that from all accounts, it seems like everyone just thinks he's just like a total, you know, total moron, basically, which is what Rex Tillerson allegedly used to call him. Like, I saw this morning there was an interview that came out with Chris Wallace or something, and Chris Wallace were disputing about some test, some cognitive test that was taken. Yeah. Did you see that?
I did.
And Trump, there was something like, you know, Trump was telling Chris Wallace, you know, you won't be able to do these questions. They're very hard towards the end. And Chris Wallace is like, not really. I mean, it's just counting 7 back from 100. And then Trump starts like breaking. He's like, it's 93. You know, the answer is 93. Like, they're like, it just seems, it's so surreal, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I just saw that this morning. That was insane. I don't understand how anybody can take him seriously, but
honestly, dude, I'll say this much, because I mean, you both know like my views on a lot of this. Tim, we'll talk. I rather talk with you more in private about shit. But like,
sure.
Like, as far as like the Trump administration and what my friend Zach always says this, I guess this is a good way to put it, is like, how are we better off now than we were 4 years ago? And the problem
is...
You
stole that from Reagan. Your friend is a...
Zach? You can call him a thief. You have his Twitter fucking handle. I don't give a shit. Anyway, whatever. I don't... It's very... All right, it's very, very
how
weird.
How are we worse off than 4 years ago?
No. My buddy's at like, or how are we better off? I'm sorry. How are we better off now than we were 4 years ago? And it blows my fucking mind that these people, like the Trump supporters, dude, I've been doing more reading. A lot of them are, and I didn't know this. I didn't realize how big of an issue this was. A lot of them are conspiracy theorists, like really hardcore conspiracy theorists. And they think that he is trying to take down basically the Illuminati, for lack of a better word, or the New World Order, whatever, by himself. And it, like, the fact that to me, that speaks levels to the intellectual level of America, is that a good part of the president's supporters believe in batshit crazy, old archaic, you know, Christian, Judeo-Christian conspiracy theories. It blows my fucking mind that, like, that's where we're at. And he fuels it. Like, he fuels it all the time to get his people riled up. It's insane to me.
Yeah, I mean, he knows what to get. He knows what, you know, even before he ran for office, I think the most telling quote, I don't know it verbatim, but he was like, you know, if I ever wanted to be president, the easiest would be to run as a Republican, you know, because he knows. I mean, allegedly there's some evidence that when he would talk about the wall, like, he never intended to build a wall. Like, he never, like, everything that he said, these were all just like, you know, grenades to rile people up. And he knows how to, like, do you really think that he, I mean, I, you know, some people say it, who cares what's in his heart of hearts, but like, I find it hard to believe that this dude, you know, in New York City, totally, you know, cheating on his wife with pornographic actresses, spending, you know, all this money, all this gambling, really gives a shit about like prayer in public schools. You know, he's right. Like, yeah, goes out there and says like, yeah, you know, no, because he knows that's what evangelicals want to hear. And that as long as he advances,
you can't hold your Bible in the same hand that you fingered a porn star with.
You know, it's just, and evangelicals, my understanding, because there was a huge concern, like, how are they voting for him? You know, and it's like, well, he's just advancing their causes. You know, he's their vehicle. Like, yeah, maybe he's totally an immoral dude, but he knows what he's doing too. He advances these things. He throws these things out because I don't know. Who knows what his end game is? If it's power, if he really gives a shit about anything at all. I mean, yeah, I mean, it's just, but you know, I think this crisis or COVID is also revealing a lot. I mean, I think Trump, you're right, like has revealed a lot about, you know, the mindset of a lot of Americans. They believe in this conspiracy theory, but like even COVID, like, you know, I know a lot of it is like culture war. The reason why people don't want to wear a mask is like, I don't want the government telling me what to do, but some of it's gotta be like nihilism or like maybe people just don't even care if they die or something, you know, because like all, or maybe they don't, I mean, it's hard for me to believe that people know that people are dying. You know, they know that people are being hospitalized, but they're still refusing to wear a mask. And it's like, yeah, it's just reveal. I think Trump and this crisis is revealing a lot of really problematic ways of thought amongst, you know.
Yeah, people. It's unfortunate because it seems like the big thing that has been advanced by Trump is don't trust the media, and the media is the people that are reporting wear a mask, and now his people are like, well, don't trust the media. Well, now I'm not going to wear the mask, and it's a mess.
Right. Yeah. 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 Some of it is definitely that in science too, you know, doubting climate change and, but then how, like, I mean, what if you are one of those people and then you're like, you're in Florida or, and then you're like, grandmother or your parent dies, you know, it's like there's got to be at this point there's thousands if not millions of people who know someone who's been hospitalized or died, so they're like real life experience kind of runs contrary to like what Trump is saying. And yeah, I just don't know. Yeah, I don't know. And maybe it's like a study to be done or something like this, but yeah, it's, you know, it's really fascinating and disconcerting all at once.
My argument on the whole COVID, like those people like who don't want to wear a mask, who wanted things reopened, which things shouldn't be reopened. I don't think things should be reopened where there's like, they need to set like a basement number of cases. And it's like, until you get below this, you can't talk about reopening. Or, you know, you can't roll out your plan for reopening until you reach that, you know, until you reach this amount and we can see an actual, you know, curve downwards. Because we all knew when they reopened everything that within 2 weeks we were going to see a spike number of cases. And that's exactly what happened. So these people don't want to listen to anybody. So they're listening to the one guy who they think who I don't know if they even think he has their best interests at heart. I don't even know if it's that. I'm not sure if I think like a lot of them just want to see a show.
I
think that's all it is. I think they just like they want, you know, these people who wear this QAnon shit to his rallies and like all this crazy fucking stupid bullshit that these people could focus their efforts on in many other better places. But there's all this stuff and these people are the ones that are supporting them. And like, that's what I just blows my mind. It blows my fucking mind.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I think that there is like, for some people, what they would articulate as like a refreshing element to his kind of like, political discourse, if you will, you know, the shit he says. There's an interesting book I use in one of my classes. It's like a study in Louisiana, and this woman goes down there, sociologist, and lives, you know, initially she's interested in Tea Partiers and why do they hold this view, but then Trump comes on the scene, and like a lot of them say that like you know, they find the things that he says refreshing. And, you know, they all, at the end of the day, you know, she finds that they agree with this, you know, she would interview them. And finally she kind of came up with how they felt. And then she articulated it to them and they were like, yeah, totally. Like they feel like there's like a line in the US that moves towards the American dream. And like, they're like these white rural people, not just rural, but she's in a rural countryside and kind of like Louisiana in the swamps, and that they feel like, you know, the government is putting like immigrants and refugees and women before them and kicking these white people back to the line. And then like, finally this dude comes along and he's like, you know, why are we concerned with like immigrants? Why are we concerned with refugees? You know, we should be concerned with the people here. We should bring jobs back. And like all this type of thing. I mean, even now with the Confederate like monuments and whatnot, he's like, you know, we shouldn't erase history. We shouldn't erase these Confederate monuments. He's like, he gives voice to like these like white racial resentment, you know, like white people that blame kind of like all their woes on like immigrants and racial minorities and the government and shit like this. And it's like, yeah, like many of these people are in a shitty situation. But maybe it's because the government like hasn't done enough like to be involved in whatever it is, childcare, roads, education. Mm-hmm. It's not because, you know, it's not, immigrants or something like this. Maybe it is a corporate executive who shipped jobs overseas, you know.
Yeah,
that blame is legitimate, you know.
So I guess the question I have to wrap this all up then is, since our domestic policy has basically switched to blatant racism, is this going to affect future foreign policy? Is it going to be less effective because basically we spent the last 4 years proving to the world that we don't know what we're doing?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that's the big question right now. Really under like, I see a lot of international relations, former diplomats kind of asking this question, like, how is it that the US can repair relations? I mean, I think that this is probably going to push, you know, at present, China is making a lot of inroads across the world in terms of like funding development projects and providing loans to countries and initiating trade policy. You know, once Trump kind of cut the ties with, you know, implemented tariffs on Chinese imports and all this type of thing, like China went to Brazil and established all these sorts of relations. Like, you know, China has the capability to rearrange things really quickly because of government control. And, you know, supply chains are very hard to otherwise, my understanding is, to kind of develop or repair, whatever you want to say.
Right.
So I think, I mean, I guess, I think a lot of countries are going to be a little bit worrisome in the least, given that the possibility of a Trump or a future Trump exists. And that maybe that, you know, whereas countries perhaps before during the mid 20th century often looked towards the US for leadership and for loans, that, you know, China, like as we were talking about earlier, you know, Soviet Union provided sort of an alternative example of development and this sort of a thing. Like China increasingly, I think, is, at least in terms of economic development, providing a, perhaps, you know, more of an example than the US. And just, you know, yeah, I mean, I think that's what we could say right now, that, you know, countries will probably be more worrisome, I guess, of establishing intensive relations with the US. I mean, I don't think Trump is totally damage the reputation of the US beyond repair. Obama, you know, he went on his European sort of forgiveness tour, you know, apologizing for the Bush administration and whatnot. So, I mean, that's certainly always there. But I mean, you know, under Biden, like, he would probably still want to you know, he probably still wants to, you know, get rid of Maduro and the socialists in Venezuela, get rid of leftist governments in Latin America. He's probably still going to be buddies with Saudi Arabia. So in some respects, some things, you know, might not even change. And some countries are still going to be, some leadership and some groups throughout the world are still going to be, you know, sort of pissed off, for lack of a better word, towards the US. And you know, certainly more domestic policy has changed under Trump than foreign policy. Trump has sort of laid bare a lot of, you know, the assumptions that I think a lot of previous presidents tried to cloak. You know, he said, like, if you don't get on board with us, we're going to cut off aid. That was always unspoken, but I think a lot of countries knew that if they didn't vote alongside the U.S. and the U.N. on issues involving Israel or the U.S. or whatever, that the U.S. would cut off their aid. But Trump's just made it all very plain. Mm-hmm. And there are other things I think that'll be hard to repair as well. I mean, he wants to get out of the World Health Organization, NATO he's talked about. So it's possible that, you know, he's tried to isolate the U.S. So it is possible that, you know, countries are going to seek to create organizations and do things that perhaps don't involve the U.S. You know, Latin America did a lot of this under Hugo Chavez and under Bush and whatnot. They wanted to create regional organizations, and perhaps, you know, we'll see more of that sort of development, trying to make things happen at the global level without necessarily the assistance of the U.S. because the U.S. is just so unpredictable now, you know?
Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens when we become more predictable.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll see. So Tim, where can we find you on the internet?
You can find me. I'm on Twitter, TimGill924. I'll probably have my webpage up at University of Tennessee soon, but I'm always tweeting, so you're welcome to follow me, and I'll follow you back, and thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for coming on, man.
Yeah, bud.
For sure.
Yeah. So Jordan, I don't think we're going to find anybody that hates U.S. foreign policy as much as Tim Gill.
No, there is another. I won't apologize again. I'm a rapid offender. You can see right through my skin. I don't care about making mistakes. I keep standing up and falling on my face. Feed me nothing ages. Drag me to the ring. Another discharge paper.
This has been a Lousy Weather Media Network production. Find new episodes and archives at lousyweathermedia.com.